Welcome to another episode of Pebble in the Pond. I'm your host, Talitha Natt, and this afternoon I'm sitting at the Child and Adolescents Mental Health Conference here in the Gold Coast with Professor Susan Danby. Professor Susan Danby is recognised internationally as one of Australia's leading experts in young children's engagement with digital technologies, social interaction, and childhood studies. As director of the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child, Suzanne leads a collective of national and international researchers and partners across government, industry, and the community to further the centre's vision. Young children are healthy, connected, and educated in a rapidly changing digital age. Welcome on board, Suzanne.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming to chat with me. Now, I'd like to understand more about the work that you do at the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child. Now, that's quite a mouthful. Is there an abbreviation for that by any?
A little bit shorter. So it's also known as the ARC, Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child.
Gotcha.
But we do like to say who the Australian Research Council, because the Australian Research Council is a group. It's a government body, taxpayer-funded money, and it really shows that this is the organisation. We went through a very long process of interviews and applications to reach the funding for this particular centre. So it's pretty exciting that we have it. It's the first one in early childhood education, and of course digital technologies is everybody's concern, particularly around young children, which is the focus of our centre. Children from birth to about 8 years of age.
Absolutely. And I'm just curious, I mean, how did you get into this sector and the work that you do in particular? Can you talk us through maybe a bit about your career, where you started, and take us through your journey?
Right. So I started my professional life as a preschool teacher. So I did a diploma of teaching, a three-year degree. I started by teaching preschool and primary. I taught a combined multi-level class in the bush. And then from there, I taught in various preschools and in primary school for a few years, about 7 or 8 years, I think. And then I moved overseas and moved to Chicago because I wanted to do my master's degree there. So I did my master's in early childhood education in Chicago at Erickson Institute, which is one of the well-known places to study early childhood. And it was there that I became not just interested more in early childhood education and understanding more, but I began to research, and I loved doing research. I was working in a research project, working with teachers in some of the early years classrooms around how to design and develop curriculum, and I just felt that research was the place I wanted to be. So I came back to Brisbane. I did my PhD in Brisbane at the University of Queensland, while I was also working at Queensland University of Technology, which is where I still am. And that interest in research has always been a focus of mine. I mean, I love teaching. I love teaching in the classrooms. I love teaching undergraduate and postgraduate students. So that's a really important part of my work as well. But the research component has really, I've always got questions. I'm always curious. What about this? And what about that? And one of my early projects finishing that I started after I finished my PhD was sitting on a plane flying to Darwin. And for the first time, it was just after I'd finished my PhAD. I'd not been reading magazines after, because I'd been so busy with my PhD. I was flicking through the magazine and I saw an advertisement for Kids Helpline. And it was about a little girl holding the phone, and it said children should be seen and not heard. Right. And I was like, wonder what those children talk about on Kids Helpline. What are they saying? What are they calling about? So I became really curious about what they were talking about. And that actually led to a research project about Kids Helpline. And really, we did understand what young people and children talked about and how the counsellors responded to the young people, because the Kids Helpline philosophy is we care, we listen. And these counsellors were amazing working with young children and with youth around some of the issues and concerns that they engage with. So that was one of my very early projects. But my work has really been across children talking about what they saw as risky environments, where they got to make decisions in their lives. So I've always worked from some principles around children should be heard as well as seen. and that they have opinions on things that matter to them. And this is very much part of the United Nations child rights as well, that children should be able to have a say on matters that affect them. And they have a lot to say. And very often it's quite different to what adults might think. Mm-hmm. I remember a small study that one of my students did, which was around children and who was in the school playground. And the children said, "We're told not to talk to strangers, but there's this man who keeps saying hello to us and we don't know if we should talk to him or not." Well, that was the gardener. And so nobody had kind of thought, this is a really important person in this child's life at school. And so you really get a very different perspective listening to children. And so my work has always recognized that children have a voice and children should be heard. And we listen to what children have to say from their perspectives.
On that note, I was just thinking as you were speaking about, you know, your interest or your fascination with the type of calls that could have been coming through to Lifeline at that point in time. And what do you think has changed in terms of the calls that would have been received then versus the calls that are potentially being called in now?
So it is Kids Helpline, which is a helpline for children and young people up to age 25. And they were one of the very first organizations that moved to not just phone conversation, but also online interactions, online chat, and they also had an email communication as well. So to move, to shift from face-to-face into these digital spaces meant a couple of things. First of all, it meant that people who may not ever have been able to have access to support now was able to get that. And the other part that I think was really important was that callers could, people writing in online chat, could be anonymous. So they didn't have to say who they were, where they were from. So children and young people felt, I think, much more comfortable talking to someone whom they knew would be respectful of their privacy. Mm-hmm. And when they first started out, it was a lot around, in fact, some of these things really haven't changed. It was around bullying and children being worried about bullying. As the children got older, the concerns shifted from family matters and friendships into more serious concerns around their thoughts, homelessness. Some of them talked about having to parent their parents. So as the age of the children and young people grew, so did the problems rise in severity. And that service is absolutely amazing and amazing still in supporting children and young people. So I think what's different is probably now the digital has created a whole new world of issues. And I've just come from a presentation of a survey of about 6,000 adolescents that is being developed and run by the Black Dog Institute. And they were talking about some of the major concerns. And what featured again really highly in that for adolescents was school matters, which was around the academic aspects, mm-hmm. as well as family as well. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, those concerns or issues haven't changed, but maybe some of the context around that, because we know that social media in adolescents' lives is a really big thing for them right now. And you know, how do they manage those social media sites that are very much, there's lots of influences involved in trying to promote particular kinds of ideas and topics. And, you know, in some ways, I think influencers are almost like the old fashioned commercial ad where they're trying to promote some kind of product. And so I think what's really important for our young people is really understanding things about how do you make assessments about what you're watching on social media? What kinds of tools do you use to be able to make sense of that? And this really falls within a media literacy approach that should be started with children in preschool, you know, to be able to look at something that they're watching or seeing. Make some assessments about it. Is this something that is based on some kind of knowledge that we know and value, or is this something that is somebody's personal opinion? Where's the evidence base, and how do we know that? How do we make those kinds of decisions? And it can be done in a very child-friendly oriented way when we take into account children and their age, but also their experiences. So children can understand about algorithms, for example, very young by taking photos. And this is one of the projects in our center where children took a series of photos and then they sequenced those photos and talked about how that's how algorithms work in these kind of online experiences.
Sure. Where
data gets pointed more and more.
Talking about the project at your centre, are you able to shed any light on the Global First study of 3,000 families to provide the big picture on digital technologies in early childhood? That sounds yes. like quite the project.
Yes. So this is our longitudinal study. It's called the CODA, Australian Children of a Digital Age Longitudinal Study. We are just about to roll this longitudinal study out this year. It's been a long time putting it together. We now have 5,000 families that we'll be targeting. And we'll be asking families with children aged from birth onwards up to about 4 years of age, some of their experiences of how much digital technology are they using in the home, what kinds of things for what purposes, what about sleep, what about ways that it's used for learning, making sure that we get a representative group of families so that we can understand what's happening in all the multitude of different families that we have in Australia, to understand more about this and to understand how change happens over time. So this will be a survey that will be carried out over 5 years, and through that information we'll have a wonderful understanding of what's actually happening with very young children, which hasn't been done before. Often these surveys start with children a little bit older, but we're starting from birth. We want to see what kinds of digital footprints already these young children and babies even start life with, for example, and then follow through these children. So we don't have data yet, but we have a survey that's just about to be rolled out.
So how long would this project take from, I guess, the initial beginnings of coming up with the actual project, rolling it out? I mean, to ask 5,000 families those questions is, I'm assuming, very time consuming.
Yes.
Plus doing the survey for the 5 years thereafter. I mean, yes. How long is the life cycle of this project?
Well, if at the moment it will be a 5-year cycle of data collection.
Right.
And then I hope that we can find some support to continue that study into another 5 years, perhaps, because the database that will come out of the study will be so important. And we'll be watching these children from birth into age 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera. So
fascinating.
Really important for Australia to understand what's happening with children.
And can I ask, when it comes to early childhood and our evolving world of technology, what are some of the things we should be keeping an eye on, both rather from a positive impact perspective as well as a cautionary aspect?
Okay. So I think there are some three main challenges that are on my radar at the moment. And I always think challenges are good to think about because then you have to start thinking about what are the opportunities then. So a large one I know amongst parents is they are completely bombarded with social media, and they're being all their posts, they're getting influencer posts coming in, all kinds of things. And parents sometimes, often, don't know where to go to get some really good understandings about digital technology and their children. So that's a really big issue for every parent, I think, in Australia, about how to manage that. And we do have guidelines. So we have pediatric guidelines. We have Australia 24-hour movement guidelines. We have the Early Childhood Australia organization has digital child guidelines, but they all say different things. So parents not quite sure where to go to for information. So one of the things that we'll be doing in the center is to build a set of guidelines that will be used across all avenues, health, education and so on. And the COVID pandemic has really changed that, because some of the guidelines say there should be no digital technology before 2 years of age. But we know during COVID that social media, FaceTime, Zoom and so on was so important for families to stay in touch. So the question also has changed from how much time — everybody was wanting to know how much time should my child be online. It's a bit like, you know, how many steps should you do in a day? But that's a really shorthand way to understand it. It's better to understand it around what are the children doing online? Who are they doing this with? And what kind of content? So we want content where children are producing things, doing things, rather than simply consuming knowledge or whatever of it, entertainment. So I think in terms of where we go here, we really need to think about some guidelines that are universal, that are supporting parents to do that work, and also for educators as well. There's been some work in that space, but we also need to keep on top of that. Yeah. Another big issue is around how COVID really changed learning from home, and where technology wasn't necessarily a big part of family lives, it started to become a big part of family lives. But of course, that raised its own issues. So for instance, children who live in rural and remote and regional Australia may not have access to the internet. So it's very hard to do learning when you don't have access to the devices or the internet to be able to engage in that kind of work. So it really showed up the huge digital divide that we have in Australia around people who have access and people who do not. And it also showed up knowledge around how children learn, because you can't just take something that might be face-to-face and then put it online. There's a lot of work, a lot of knowledge to be done building pedagogy to help any kind of learning that happens online. So that's been a very steep learning curve. And I think the third area that's really on people's radar right now is safety, e-safety. So privacy is a really big issue for when children sign up, when we sign up to a, you know, we want to watch that game or see something, and we have to sign up to that app, and we go through hundreds of pages, and then we just agree to it. But in fact, we probably haven't even read it. This is data that's being collected, and a number of app developers are collecting that data, and it raises a whole lot of questions around children and adults and their privacy. So there's some work being done on this. The former government started a privacy bill, and there's work being done in our centre that's really looking at that. One of our wonderful partners in the centre is the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. So we work very closely with some of the big organisations to support the work of the centre. We have about 30-odd projects going in the centre, as well as the longitudinal study. So it's a huge amount of work, and it happens across. What we want to make sure is at the end of the day, we have children who are healthy and educated and connected. So the work sits across that whole child, if you like.
In your experience and your research, are you able to describe the impact on a child's mental wellbeing when they are exposed to or use digital technology on a regular basis? That's quite a big
one. It's a big question.
Yeah.
And the short answer is there's really a lot more research to be undertaken in this space. So people sometimes see a connection as causal between a child's behavior and digital technology, but I don't think there's enough evidence yet to be really very clear about that. Sometimes people say, a really good example is the myth that children's eyesight children became short-sighted because of that research has actually been debunked. So there's a whole lot of what is seen as causal actually is not true. So the children's eyesight, for instance, you need to have children outside because it's that outside looking at a distance, all of that kind of work actually works against myopia. So there's a whole lot of research there and a lot of myths. Another myth is around the digital native, the idea that every child is somehow rather born with the gene to understand digital technology. And that's not true either. So these kinds of relationships and these kind of myths that develop, sleep is another one. Sleep is an area that people have a lot to say about, blue light and so on and so forth. But the connections aren't necessarily very clear about that. And we think that probably children and adults, I mean, we do it. We stay up late online looking at something online and the photos from the party that morning or whatever it was. And that stimulates us. And so it could be that it's the stimulation of our thinking and our excitement, what we're reading online rather than actual device itself. So there's a lot of work to be done in that space.
And in your opinion, I mean, how much is too much screen time? I mean, that's probably another question which, you know, everyone would have an answer for, but what do you think?
Well, the studies seem to show that some technology is very useful for children. They need that as part of their learning opportunities. It opens the world for them. It's like as one teacher said, it's like a magic carpet where they can learn so much online. And of course, too much is being found to be a problem as well. But I think we need to shift the question from how much time to what are we actually doing online. So we know that it's really important for when you're engaging online that you think about who are you doing that with. So a child, for instance, we need to have look at the role of parents and teachers and educators in this space. And I always suggest to parents, what you need to do is I say, engage, don't surveil. Because parents quickly want to rush to put boundaries and limits and just turn off technology at a particular time. And TikTok has just brought in a new policy around the 1 hour. But I don't think that's the answer. The answer is, if you're talking to grandma, I've got some great data of a little three-year-old cooking with grandma. Grandma's in her kitchen a few states away, and three-year-old is cooking in her kitchen and they're cooking together. Now, that's a wonderful example of how digital technology can work. So it's around who are you with and who are you engaging with? What are you doing is important. So is it something that's imaginative and creative? And digital gaming can fit into that category. And also the actual game itself, the actual whatever, whether it's a web page where you're looking up information or whatever. But it's really important to look at that relationship. And I say to parents, hop online, whatever game or whatever app your child is on, whatever platform your child is on, join it. You know, if it's TikTok, join it. Get some of your friends together and work out what's happening in TikTok or work out whatever's happening in the game that your child's playing. Because what you want the children to understand is they need to be able to know that they can go to someone if they have questions or concerns. And they're probably less likely to do that if they think they're going to get into trouble because they've ended up on a site where they shouldn't. And also by the parent understanding the game or the activity online, the parent can engage in a more comprehensive discussion. And what you're wanting is to have this space where children can come to talk about any concerns that they might have or talk about the games or talk about what they're doing. So be engaged. Don't just surveil is really important. I think the other part of that too is putting into place some understandings. You know, there's a lot of talk around children being addicted to digital gaming. And I think there's this image of children being in a dark room by themselves, gaming alone. But the reality is they're often probably gaming with their friends from school. It's no longer such a stranger. There's obviously those issues, but mostly they're probably gaming with their friends. And then imagine they're halfway through a game, they're part of a team, and they're getting so close to winning. And then someone calls out, dinner's ready. And so what happens? If they move away from the game, they're going to let their peers down. They're going to let their friends down because all of a sudden they probably will lose the game. So it's around parents negotiating with children and young people. You know, how much time do you think you need to play this game? Okay, so let's do dinner at 7 o'clock tonight or whatever it is, to put in place recognizing that children and young people really do need to manage those friendships, et cetera, as well. So rather than yelling out, come now, you know, find a way that it can be more, they can be more supportive. One of the pieces of work we're doing in the center is working with Lego and UNICEF. And UNICEF has designed, in collaboration with a number of universities, a wellness framework. And then the next step now has been using that framework and engaging children in playing games. And what's interesting in the data that's coming through is that particularly when children are social playing digital games, they're supporting each other, they're scaffolding together, they're problem solving together. The more experienced person is supporting the less experienced person to play the game. And we ask, why is this important? Because it's important because we need those skills. We need to know how to problem solve. We need to know how to game, to set goals. We need to know how to collaborate and cooperate with each other. So these are life skills that will support children and young people all the way through their lives. So really important that we look at that. And it's an interesting study because we've brought together biometric data. So things like sweat, heart rate, where the child's gaze is on the screen playing the game. And then we've video recorded that. And then we've shown the children both their biometric data and also the video of them playing the game. And you know, there's one example where one of the boys lost the game and his heart rate went right up. And we said, oh, what do you think happened here? Because we thought, well, he'd lost the game, so maybe he was feeling disappointed about it. And he went, no, no. He said, I was so excited because even though I lost the game, he said, I played with somebody who was better than me and I learned some strategies. Mm. So here's this self-actualization of what he had learned through that experience. And so, again, going back to asking children and young people, their perspectives on things is really important. So,
such fascinating things. And I think there's a lot of work and research and insights that's going to be coming to the fruition over the next few years, and certainly as a result of the work that you do. So thank you so much for bringing your insights and your wisdom to this episode of Pebble in the Pond. And I really appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan.
Distinguished Professor Susan Danby is recognised internationally as one of Australia's leading experts in early years language and social interaction, childhood studies, and young children's engagement with digital technologies. As director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child, Susan leads a collective of national and international researchers and partners across government, businesses, and the community to work towards the centre's vision, ensuring young children are healthy, connected, and educated in a rapidly changing digital age. In today's episode, we discuss the mission for the Centre of Excellence for Digital Child, what the latest research says, and the role of parents, teachers, and educators in the space. Welcome, Susan.